Okay, this is May 30th, 2004 in San Antonio, Texas, the Army Nurse Corps Association Convention, and I am with Pat Gorin.
No. Pat
Gorman.
G-O-R-M-A-N.
Sorry. This is why I had it spelled wrong earlier. Pat Gorman, and I'm Kira Buick. So let's just start with where you grew up and were born and raised.
I was born in Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up there. I was educated there. I lived there for many years. And that's the start of my existence.
Mm-hmm.
Parents, married, of course. We're a regular family. I had only one living sibling. There was another child who died before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up, really, it was just my sister and myself. She's younger than I am. We lived in a neighborhood initially called Crown Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was a teenager, we moved to a place called Bay Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in Bay Ridge until I finally left New York City.
Mm-hmm.
In the interim, I went to Roman Catholic parochial school, grammar school, St. Gregory's High School, Bishop McDonald High School. And at the end, the senior year in the high school, I decided to go into nursing. And the why of that, I'm still not certain why. I was not a child who had always wanted to be a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last year, the last several months of my high school, I had been going around, had been accepted at several colleges. And I think I was worried to some extent about the financial expense.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, it would be good if I could go to some kind of school that didn't cost a lot of money, but that would enable me to make a living. And then be able to pursue my education as I desired.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of it. It was all very complicated. There was no reason, and there were some reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to go into nursing school. There were several of my good friends in the high school who were going into nursing school, so we all went to the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a 3-year nursing school, a diploma school.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate, and I've been fortunate throughout my career, mentors. And I was going to call her the chief nurse, but in the civilian place it was called director of nursing. And she advised me to start going to school to get my degrees as soon as possible. And I did, and she accommodated my going to school by letting me work different shifts. So I worked evening shifts for about 4 years so I could go to school in the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked night shift for about 3 or 4 years so I could continue going to school and get my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I became a faculty member at the School of Nursing.
Mm-hmm.
At that particular location. And during all of that time, my clinical nursing experiences were in emergency room, medical nursing, dialysis nursing, intensive care nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And then kept going to school and became a supervisor in the clinical setting as well. Then became a faculty member at that School of Nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there for a total of too many years. I stayed there altogether through the clinical nursing, the going to school, and the teaching for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided enough is enough. And I looked for some other opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became a faculty member at a baccalaureate school of nursing in Detroit, Michigan, Mercy
mm-hmm.
College. It's now part of the University of Detroit. Well, I was there for 3 years, and in the back of my mind, I had always thought, not seriously, but it was always there, I had been interested in military nursing. At the end of 3 years at Mercy College, I said, well, I have enough of this kind of experience, I'd like to go on and try something new.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I came in contact with the Army nurse recruiter, and of course then they were building up in Vietnam and they were having casualties and they needed healthcare personnel and they were out recruiting, and I said, well, that sounds like a good place to get a different view of the healthcare world and the nursing world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined the Army.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember talking to the recruiter a lot? And
no.
I think she told you, or was it a he or she?
It was a she, young officer, very personable, not pushy.
Mm-hmm.
And her life was complicated by the fact that I was at a juncture, so she was recruiting me in Detroit, but I was moving to New York. to make a decision about where I was going, because I wasn't staying at Mercy College. I wanted to go on and do other things. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I was at a juncture, and she had to put up with me being in Detroit but moving to New York. Right. There was not, I don't remember any pushing. I don't remember anything but helpfulness. Mm-hmm. And trying to show me what the advantages of the military might be.
Mm-hmm. And what does she say those advantages were?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Because at that point, I'd been a professional for a lot of years. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of experience. Mm-hmm. I knew that I wanted new experiences. And I knew that I had something to offer any organization that I went to.
Uh-huh.
So it was kind of that I was a completely different input than a young person who's coming right out of school,
right,
and is looking for the monetary educational experiences or advantages that they might get, as well as travel around the world. Maybe travel was of interest to me, because I was interested in that time in travel.
Uh-huh.
So maybe travel was of interest.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember getting a lot of push from the recruiter.
Uh-huh. Did you have brochures or things you remember getting, or posters you saw or anything like that?
I might have seen a poster of somebody in uniform,
mm-hmm,
but I really don't remember a lot of that PR type of stuff.
Uh-huh.
I really don't. So then I went off back to Brooklyn,
mm-hmm,
and they transferred my paperwork and they transferred the action to the nurse recruiter in New York. And I know that I remember that I had gotten my physical while I was in Detroit, and then the recruiter in New York, very nice young lady, she was a captain. And I had to go to this old building in downtown Manhattan. It was one of the, what I remember most about that place, it was one of the ones that had one of those old cage elevators that went, mm-hmm, up the middle of the building.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I remember. Whitehall Street, I think it was. And she continued the process for me and addressed me by a rank. And she made a comment to me, and she said, it's going to be very interesting for me, she said, because I'm a captain, and you're going to be getting this rank of major. And rank had no meaning to me at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned later, I got my letter of acceptance, and my papers, my official papers. And it was addressed to major. And at that time, it turns out that they were giving, what did they call it? They were giving credit for advanced education and experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a certain term which escapes me now. Constructive credit, that's what they call it. They were giving constructive credit for education and experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I was given the rank of major when, mm-hmm, I first came in. So my process was completed, and I was commissioned in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And at those couple of months I was at home, I went back to Brooklyn to stay with my folks while I was waiting for all of this to settle out. And because of what was going on in Vietnam, I said, oh, that would be interesting. In my head, I'm saying, that would be an interesting experience to go into a combat zone and see what that kind of, that would certainly be different from what I've been doing. And that was what I was looking for, something different.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked for what they called a guaranteed assignment. And that is when, that is one of the things that they used to bring people in, was that you were given a guaranteed assignment and you could ask for wherever you wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked for Vietnam, so.
Mm-hmm.
I got orders, and I was given a guaranteed assignment.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to basic training here in Fort Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And one funny story happened there. The recruiter said to me, well, you're going for basic at Fort Sam, Houston, Texas, on a certain report on a certain date. So I had no idea where Fort Sam, Houston, Texas was. So I was proceeding, to go to the airport. And I was planning on buying a ticket to Houston, Texas, because, of course, Fort Sam Houston had to be in Houston, right? So, but no, luckily she caught me before I did that and told me, no, you should go to San Antonio. So I came down to San Antonio, I think it was July or August of 1966. Hot. Big basic classes, because, again, the big push in Vietnam for medical personnel. So there were immense classes of physicians, nurses, medical service corps officers who are the administrators and other types in hospital care,
mm-hmm,
veterinary corps officers. I think our Army Nurse Corps basic class was probably almost 300 people.
Mm-hmm.
And the we were assigned to quarters. So we went through all the processing, which was a whole new world. It's like getting registered in school. If you can get through registration, you can get through anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you can get through in processing, you can get through anything, really. So we got in processing, we got assigned to quarters. We were living in big, not barracks, we were living in high-rise apartments or bachelor officer quarters, they called them at that time. And mm-hmm. you would probably, I think the buildings are still in existence on Fort Sam
mm-hmm.
Houston.
Mm-hmm.
So we were up there. And they warned us, you know, because of safety reasons, we should always make sure our doors were locked and that kind of thing. It was so hot. I remember we all kept our doors open, you know, just
mm-hmm.
gave us a little air at nighttime.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, what were they afraid of?
Well, you know, intruders and your physical safety. You know,
mm-hmm.
they didn't want robbers coming in and killing you while you were in basic training,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. So, because it was a fairly open, I think it was an open post. I mean, there weren't a lot of guards. There were the guards posted to the gates, but nobody, people could have gotten
mm-hmm.
in if they had really wanted to. So, anyway, it was like if you were staying in a hotel. They don't want
mm-hmm.
you sleeping with your doors open
uh-huh.
in a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
The same kinds of reasons. So we came and processed in, and the first day that we got together as a class, I was called out of the classroom and brought up to the office of the man who was in charge of the basic training part of the training process at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and informed, nicely, but informed that since I was the senior person in this group of nurses that was reporting in, that I would be the class leader. Well, I almost had a heart attack. What did I know about the Army, class leader? But in terms of rank and in terms of also probably of age, I was the senior person, so I was going to be the class leader.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness that my executive officer, my so to speak assistant,
mm-hmm.
who was in the base that same class, was a man, Ed Cummings. I'll never forget him. And he had had service before becoming a nurse. He had
mm-hmm.
had service as a Marine
mm-hmm.
in, I think, Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So he saved my life. He was really good. So we went through our basic training. It was quite an experience, and some of the people that I met there are still friends today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a unifying experience. And then after basic training, I didn't go straight to my guaranteed assignment. I went for an interim assignment at Letterman Army Medical Center in San Francisco. And that was, for me, very, very valuable, because since I had this advanced grade, I was expected to have knowledge of and be able to perform as a major.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't get any slack for the fact that you're brand new walking in the door, so I had to run to catch up for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who were at Letterman, the chief nurse there, Colonel Rosasco, who just died recently, they were wonderful to me. They provided me an orientation program
mm-hmm.
that was superb. And I had been in education and training a lot as a civilian, so I knew,
mm-hmm.
and I had hoped that something like that would happen, but it was beyond my hopes, and it was really a wonderful experience in terms of the people I met
mm-hmm.
and the experiences they provided for me.
Mm-hmm.
Then that was, I got there, I think, in October.
Mm-hmm.
And we got orders finally that we were going to go overseas to Vietnam. Our reporting date over there was, I think, the end of March.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we're there for several months.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people who were assigned at Letterman were assigned to the same unit going overseas. So that was a nice bonding experience, that you got to know these people that you would be working with in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
So then, had
you really thought about the war in terms? Politically?
Phyllis, no, after we talked, I thought to myself, and no, I didn't. Philosophically, politically, that was
mm-hmm.
not part of my mindset. I was not thinking about it. I was only, I think, thinking of it in terms American soldiers were getting hurt. I had a capability to provide some assistance,
uh-huh.
and I thought it would be a good idea to go. But in terms of political terms, of philosophical terms about the war in Vietnam,
uh-huh.
that was not part of my psyche at the time.
Uh-huh.
No. So uh-huh. I went over there in a strictly apolitical mode.
Mm-hmm. Just nursing?
It was nursing.
Uh-huh. Had you heard anything about maybe World War II nurses, or did you know anything about
wartime
nursing?
The reason I had been an interest in military nursing
mm-hmm.
many years before, that was kind of in a subconscious level in my mind, was when I was in my basic nursing program, They did have recruiters from the military nurse services come and talk to us. I remember there were three came representing the Army, Navy, and Air Force. And they gave a very interesting presentation, and that's, you know, a basic interest. And along the line, while I was doing nursing at that at the place where I went to school and where I worked for so long, a lot of the physicians there had been men who had been in, who had been high school graduates and then had been drafted into World War II and then had come out and used the GI Bill to go to college and to go to medical school. So a lot of them had that bonding, and you would hear the talk, you know, and they would talk about those experiences and this personnel, and now they were docs, and they were just very interesting. And the same thing with Korea. Some of them had come out of high school or college, gone to Korea as physicians, and come back, and you know, you hear that kind of experience. And more than one of them talked to me about Army nurses. I remember that. So all of that was there in my experience, but I don't know that that really pushed me, because by the time I was leaving Detroit and going on to different things was probably more in the uppermost of my mind than those previous conversations about military nursing. But it wasn't my background. I did have that knowledge. So when I went to Vietnam, like I say, I was apolitical. And I can continued to be that way because I don't remember being concentrated on anything but the living and working while I was there. You know, we didn't have the kind of email you have nowadays where news gets around the world before you can blink an eyelash. And newspapers were hard come by, and the Stars and Stripes, and the folks used to send me some of the other magazines. But so in those terms, no. The one thing that was very different for me, and for several of them, but because that class of nurses that I came in with, that almost 300 strong class, were rather atypical, I think, because while a lot of people coming into the military at that time were young, right out of school kinds of people, this class particularly had a lot of experienced nurses in it. We had a lot of people in that class, probably at least half of them, if not the majority of them, who had been nurses for quite a while, and who were not brand new out of school. So it wasn't the young, dewy-eyed people coming down the street. And, but in terms of talking politics while we were in school, I don't remember. That that wasn't a major thing on our minds, going through that basic class. And when we got to Vietnam, this group of nurses that were assigned to this particular hospital, again, it would probably half and half by the time the full complement of nurses arrived, because that was an evacuation hospital, and I think at that time, TONE called 57 nurses in an evacuation hospital, and probably it was half and half experienced people with a lot of civilian experience. We had experienced people with a lot of Army nursing experience as well, and then about half were new, fairly new or new graduates. So it was kind of even Steven in terms of nursing staff. And I spent the whole year in Vietnam at the one location. Many nurses went to several locations while they were there. And I came back, and where was I assigned next? Oh, I know, I came back, and I was assigned at the old Medical Field Service School, now the Academy of Health Sciences, where they do all of the training. And that, again, was another, and of course, I should speak about the experience in Vietnam, tremendous learning experience in terms of professional nursing. I had always been very interested in, particularly in communicable and infectious diseases, and we saw things there that you would never see here in the United States. Because we took care of people in the hospital, we took care of native Vietnamese, as well as our own troops, as well as enemy troops, as well as foreign nation troops. So we saw things you would never see in the United States, and that was a lot of interest to me.
What ward did you work on?
I was the head nurse at the medical intensive care unit. But then I was there during Tet as well. I came home about a month. I came home about 6 to 8 weeks after Tet, and overnight, my medical intensive care ward turned into a surgical intensive care ward. So along the line, I got both sides of the coin. And it used to be concerning to me because of concern to me because people didn't appreciate, for my medical patients, the people who had, say, acute malarial episodes. And I don't think a lot of people appreciated that these people were just as much, what's the word when somebody is shot? They were just as much victims of of the circumstances as someone who was shot by a bullet. And, mm-hmm. you know, just because they were shot by a bug didn't make them any less important in the whole value scheme.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting. Then when I came back, I was assigned at the Medical Field Service School. And that was another learning experience for me because, again, I had to be running to catch up, to be teaching people some mm-hmm. of these concepts about the military and Army nursing. While I had some background, now it was only a year, maybe mm-hmm. 2 years, and here I'm doing this. Worked with some wonderful people, some women who were wonderful mentors to me. In fact, some of them are here at the conference, and I still feel like they're some of my best friends. And some of the people that I'm staying with are people that I met while I was assigned there, people who were on the faculty with me. And so it was very positive in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went, where did I go from there? Medical Field Service. Oh, then at the end of that, at the end of that experience, they assigned me to go to the career course, which is a 6-month course for Army Medical Department officers, and they teach you all of these big concepts that I had to learn about kind of on the fly to be able to be teaching in the school before I went to the school. But
uh-huh.
nevertheless, one adapted. That's one of the major needs, is to adapt.
Uh-huh. And that meant you were in the regular Army then?
No, I was not, because when I came in, I was too old to go regular Army.
Oh, okay.
At the time I came in, there were kind of two horns that you had to meet to go regular Army. Well, three horns, probably. You had to be no older than a certain age. You had to have at least so many years of service, and that killed me right there because I was too old to begin with. And then the third arm was, of course, you had to have outstanding officer efficiency reports and recommendations from regular Army officers to go before the board.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I continued in what they called career reserve status. I was a reserve officer on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
But I forget when it was. It was sometime, I think, in the 1970s, when the law was changed,
mm-hmm.
and there was about a 6-month period of time
mm-hmm.
in which I became eligible to go regular Army.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I think I was assigned in Washington, D.C. at the time, and we, of course, looked through all of our records, and we sent letters to everybody that we considered eligible because of the change of law and because they met the requirement in terms of outstanding records and recommendations from people.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked them, did they want to go regular Army? Of course, I said yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I enjoyed it very much.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one of the big differences between being the voluntary indefinite career reserve and being regular Army was how long you could stay on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
The career reservist had to get off active duty at 20 years service. The regular Army officer could stay longer.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, all of this based on whether or not your performance stayed at a certain level
mm-hmm.
and whether or not you made it up through the promotion scheme, because
mm-hmm.
the promotion scheme was mostly up or out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was 2 opportunities to become promoted to the next grade, and if you failed on the second opportunity, you were invited to leave.
Invited to leave.
Yeah, well, you know. So.
Uh-huh. But you had decided to make the Army a career.
Yes, because at that point I had decided I liked the people. That was always uppermost.
Mm-hmm.
And every day wasn't roses, but I had so many positive experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I liked about it, I had so many opportunities to progress in an organization where I had opportunities to do different things. In a civilian community institution, you would continue doing clinical, and that's what some nurses want to do. They want to do nothing but clinical nursing their
mm-hmm.
whole career. I was interested in doing different things,
mm-hmm.
and the Army gave me the perfect opportunity to be able to do that within the framework of the same organization, so clinical, administrative, education, research.
Mm-hmm.
It was, all those opportunities were there, and on top of that, the people that I got to work with, the places that I got to go, it was very positive as far as I was concerned. Like I said, every day wasn't a glorious day,
mm-hmm.
but overall, it was a wonderful opportunity, and
mm-hmm.
I never regretted a single day
mm-hmm.
that I spent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went on to different experiences
mm-hmm.
and different places, and my last series of assignments were all in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I was brought back to Washington, D.C. from Triple Army Medical Center, and there was a position at that time called Chief Nursing Education and Training, and that was the Army Nurse Corps officer who was responsible for coordinating across all of the facilities and all of the places where Army Nurse Corps officers were assigned. You had responsibility for the continuing education program, because in nursing, in order to maintain your licensure, you have to have so much continuing education credit, and also the Army Nurse Corps has always been very interested in the continuing education of its officers.
Mm-hmm.
And so this person was responsible for coordinating that across the Corps, across the AMID. And it was at that time when the states, the individual states, were starting to legislate continuing education and putting down very particular requirements mm-hmm. for approving continuing education. So that the person in that office had to make sure that all of the programs, that all of the Army Nurse Corps facilities or AMED facilities where Army Nurse Corps officers were assigned, making sure that all of their continuing education programs would fit within the requirements of all of the states.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
You got to know people outside of the military because you had to coordinate with civilian institutions,
mm-hmm.
state, health institutions, the legislative groups, the professional organizations. You had to coordinate with other specialties as well. So this
mm-hmm.
was, I have an intense curiosity about everything,
mm-hmm.
and that helped satisfy that curiosity because you were always finding out more and more about more and more, and
mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
It really kept me busy. So I came up as Chief of Education and Training. Then what did I do? Oh boy, that's then I think that was 80 to 10. Then I was selected to be Assistant Corps Chief. In 83, General Slawitzky was selected to be Chief of the Army Nurse Corps,
mm-hmm.
and she selected me to be her assistant. And that was a good experience. And in a way, I had gotten preparation for that, because in the Army Nurse Corps at that time, I don't know how it is now because I'm living apart from it and I don't know a lot of the inside workings,
mm-hmm.
but we were always interested in helping people prepare for what their future responsibilities might be. And at one assignment, I was in Washington in the mid-70s in what we call the Career Activities Office. And this was a place where you planned the assignments of Army Nurse Corps officers and you planned for their professional development as well.
Mm-hmm.
We had a wonderful chart. I hope somebody still has it. It showed a 30-year progression for Army Nurse Corps officers in terms of their education, in terms of their assignments, and in terms of their specific responsibilities during their assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the professional development branch of that office was responsible for. Well, anyway, I was assigned there, and at the time I was assigned there, one of the Corps Chiefs had been one of the officers that I knew. She was certainly very senior to me, but she had been at the academy when I was assigned, when I came back from Vietnam at
mm-hmm.
the old Medical Field Service School. And the people in the Corps Chief's office used to do a lot of traveling,
mm-hmm.
and so they needed somebody to cover their office while they were gone, to do the work, to make sure that nothing fell through the cracks,
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth. And so they kind of plucked me out of the job in the Career Activities Office to go over and be the filler when they weren't both there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the thing was, there was nobody to do the job in the Career Activities Office while I was doing the filling. So what I did during the daytime, I was over in the chief's office, and evenings and nights and weekends, I went back and did my job in the Career Activities Office. So that was a great learning experience. And it, but in essence, it prepared me for the future when
mm-hmm.
I was selected to be Assistant Chief
mm-hmm.
of the Army Nurse Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 4 years. A very satisfying, very stimulating 4 years, because General Slawitzky is something, and we had never worked together. I really didn't know the woman,
mm-hmm.
and but we meshed very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Her specific interests were here, mine were there, and we kind of met in the middle, and she was very accepting of the fact that I considered myself the naysayer in chief, because I felt as a staff officer it was one of my major responsibilities to try to figure out every angle of a proposed action or mm-hmm. things that were going on. I had to try to find out all the pluses and all the minuses mm-hmm. and all the possibilities of what could happen well and what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And when I put them on the table, she was always accepting of the fact that I never said it in so many words, but if there was some objection to be found, I would find it, because mm-hmm. I felt that was my responsibility in terms of planning and getting the Corps forward. So that was a very interesting 4 years. Mm-hmm. Then it's a 4-year term, mm-hmm. and when it was finished, I was still relatively young in terms of years on active service. I was still just around 20 or so years of active service, or maybe a little bit more. And so when the new Corps chief was selected, I asked her, I said, I'm not ready to retire yet, and is there some position that mm-hmm. you think I could fill for you and support the activities in the Corps? And there was coming open the position of a nursing consultant to the Surgeon General. There was a separate staff of consultants to the Surgeon General at that time in the different specialties within the AMED. So I went into that position, and I stayed there until I retired. Mm-hmm. So my last 10 years or so were spent in the Washington, D.C. area. Mm-hmm. And then I retired, and then Nancy Adams, who is currently Major General Nancy Adams, retired. Mm-hmm. She's here at the convention now. She stepped into that position as consultant, and since then, after that, then was selected to be Corps Chief. And that worked very nicely for her, because that put her in a position to really get a look at what was happening across the board in the organization. So again, another instance of mm-hmm. someone who went through the system, was mentored, was developed, and then was in a series of positions which were very helpful to her, were very helpful to the Army Nurse Corps, and were very helpful to the organization as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I retired, and I retired out to Santa Monica, California, and very happily so. Mm-hmm. I purposely went far away because I was so involved totally in the work of the AMED and the Army Nurse Corps that I knew that I stayed in a place that was close by, I'd get all wrapped around the axle about everything that was happening. Mm-hmm. So I figured, get myself away from it, and I think it was a good decision. Mm-hmm. So I'm retired, and that's where I am. Uh-huh. Now it's your turn. Any questions?
Well, you mentioned that you were a bit older than most of the nurses when you got to Vietnam. How mm-hmm. did that affect your experiences versus their experiences?
Well,
were they still similar or
different? I was more mature. Mm-hmm. And how do I want to put it? Because I don't want it to sound negative. But I think, in my eyes, even though it's probably not provable statistically or scientifically, a lot of people who came out with problems probably went in with problems. And I'm not referring now just to nurses. I'm talking mm-hmm. to people in general. And I think as a mature person, more mature, you learn that, you know, life is tough and everything can't be ideal, even though you make it try to be ideal. And they were torn in so many directions because things weren't the way they expected them to be. Things were very different than they expected them to be. And maybe they hadn't, you know, they were younger, and so they hadn't been able to learn to roll with a lot of punches. Mm-hmm. And that made life more difficult. Mm-hmm. But professionally speaking, any of the nurses that I worked with in Vietnam, they worked like dogs. They worked so hard. When we first got there, they were still building the hospital. And I remember we had a Quonset hut. That was where we were, had our ward. And mm-hmm. we got there in time to open up the big boxes, the Konex boxes, as they called them, where all the equipment was. So we opened the Konexes. Before we opened the Konex boxes and equipped the ward, helped paint the ward, we helped put in the electrical wiring, we helped put in the plumbing, what little plumbing we had, because we mostly, you know, had to carry the jerry cans full of water and take care of things like that. And they all worked so hard doing those kinds of things, mm-hmm. and then setting up the ward and taking care of patients. None of them slacked in terms of their professional nursing. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why some people had difficulties personally, because they worked so hard professionally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just know that the young nurses with me did a fantastic job.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any male nurses?
Yes, I did. I had two male nurses assigned to my nursing unit, and we had other male nurses in the total unit, particularly in the anesthesia section.
Mm-hmm.
Not all, but most of the nurses in our anesthesia nursing section were male. But what happened to the male nurses assigned to my nursing unit, my medical intensive care unit, I forget when it happened, but it was fairly early, first 3 months, 4 months. They were opening a hospital, or they were taking over a Navy hospital up north of us.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, I forget all the gory details, but for whatever reason, they wanted to have a majority of the staff be male nurses.
Mm-hmm.
So I lost my male nurses. And they went up, and I met a couple of them afterwards, and they said, just as well you didn't go up there, because I would have been, I was willing to go up. I said, I'll go to any new hospital that you wanted to set up, because again, I was interested in new experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But when a couple of them came back, you know, they had a chance to come back and visit just a little bit. I said, you don't want to come up there, you know, if you think it's not too nice down here, it's not even nicer up there, so
mm-hmm.
That's okay. Did
they mean in terms of living conditions?
In general, you know, mm-hmm. I guess we were fortunate where we were located. We were at a place called Tuiwa.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we're outside Tuiwa, down south a little bit of the town. We were on a beach. It was the South China Sea, the beach, the location of the hospital. Of course, we were surrounded by, there was an aviation unit here, big Chinooks that used to carry big supplies and equipment. There was a helicopter unit, and it was a POL dump, and I don't know why they put a hospital next to petroleum and oil, you know, because anything got blown up, everything got blown up. But anyway, we were on a beach, in essence, and if I hadn't had that beach, I think I might have gone bonkers while I was there, but I love to swim, and I love the beach. And after a period of time, they found a couple of men in the complement of our unit who had been lifeguards in civilian life, so we were able to use the beach periodically if we had a few free hours. So that was wonderful. So our physical location where we were, while it was hot, you know, the way in Vietnam is hot, it was one of the garden spots, as far as I was concerned, of the country, compared
mm-hmm.
to some of the locations where other hospitals were located.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the place up north, its physical location was not as pleasant as where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the working conditions were as pleasant either, and I don't know why that was. Was it in terms of the physical structures that they were given, or the availability of supplies, or what they found when they got there? So anyway, but
mm-hmm.
so I was not there to see what they were dealing with. I just got the impression that it wasn't as pleasant as what they had left.
Mm-hmm.
Where were we going?
We're talking about male nurses. I've read
yeah.
that sometimes they would want male nurses in a location that was thought to be more hostile, or that maybe there was a threat that the hospital might be infiltrated, that they would put all men there and not let, you know, any of the female nurses go.
That might be. I have no idea. I just know that
mm-hmm.
When you look at the names of the 8 nurses who were killed in Vietnam, there's only one man, and I think his death was due to a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
So that speaks. And of course, you see now in the business in Iraq that front lines don't mean anything anymore in combat, and
mm-hmm.
and where a female is assigned in terms of her duties or in terms of the unit she's assigned to, she's just as susceptible to being killed or injured as anybody else,
mm-hmm.
except maybe the men who are in a frontline infantry company,
mm-hmm.
or the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel that you were in danger or threatened, you know, in Vietnam?
I did not.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my staff did. I think the only time I was afraid was when a typhoon came through.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, because you can't do anything. I mean, bullets you can duck, but if you're lucky. But typhoon, Mother Nature, you don't
mm-hmm.
fool around with. And at one time, and we were located on the beach, as I said, and then the big main road and the rice paddies, but we were kind of almost semi-circled by mountains. Mm-hmm. And what happened, luckily we had a lot of, we had four warnings, so we stuffed sandbags, we put it on, put them on the roof and all that. But what happened, when the typhoon came in, it kind of circled around inside the mountains and really did a lot of damage, particularly the places out here. So we were lucky because we got things weighted down with sandbags, but we did not lose a lot. Mm-hmm. And of course, the quarters we were in, we were very fortunate. The quarters, we had these, we call them hooches, and they were kind of like Venetian blind sided buildings with netting up on the top of the wall in the area where you slept. So if we, I think we were shelling out sand for ages. Mm-hmm. But the buildings that were closed buildings, like the wards, they were pretty good, except where some of the roofs were blown off and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that bothered me. Oh, and then, of course, we had, when I was there for Tet, we had lots of red alerts because things were happening, but I was so tired. You were so busy taking care of patients, and then when you weren't taking care of patients, you were so tired that I don't remember being afraid. Mm-hmm. I know I read a book. One of my young nurses, anyway, her name was Lynn Hampton, and she wrote a book, and I forget the name of the book, I read it in paperback, and in it she says, Major Gorman came back from a meeting and said she was afraid. Well, I know I never said that I was afraid, because I was never afraid until the hurricane, the typhoon came through. But that's a good illustration of what happened there, as what happens in a lot of places. As I said the other night, two people in the same place at the same time and the same event, and you'll hear two completely different stories from mm-hmm. them. So, and then you just have to realize that people are having their own experiences, and you can't put what your experiences are right on top of them. You can discuss it, mm-hmm. but you'll not always come to a meeting of the minds. Mm-hmm. So that was my experience in terms of fear.
Mm-hmm. Do you read a lot of other books about that other nurses have written?
I don't make a habit of it mm-hmm. consciously or unconsciously, because I do so much other reading. Mm-hmm. And at one time when those kinds of books were first coming out, I kind of made a collection of them and tried to read them all. Mm-hmm. And then I get enough is enough. I've got other things to do with my life and read the same kinds of books. Except talking about books, there is a new book out, came out just the last couple of months, about the nurses in World War II. Mm-hmm. It is outstanding. And if you're interested at all, this beyond your need to do your work for your doctorate, mm-hmm. it's called If I Should Perish. Mm-hmm. It is so well written, mm-hmm. it's just a good read, mm-hmm. as well as documentation that has not been captured in mm-hmm. the same way elsewhere. Mm-hmm. It's really something that I've been telling everybody they need to go out and buy that book.
Go read this book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. What was it like being a woman in the military in the 60s? I mean, did you feel that you were limited, or do you feel you had more opportunities, or?
Initially, I had no feeling about it at all, because mm-hmm. again, I was kind of, I guess I was older. Mm-hmm. I knew who I was. My own good opinion of myself is probably more important to me than anybody else's opinion. So mm-hmm. that kind of thing didn't bother me too much. I guess I started being somewhat aware of that kind of thing when I became older in the military, more experienced, and was in staff positions when I was at a higher level, when I was not involved in clinical care. I guess that's it. Once you're involved, you know, being involved in clinical care, that's your major interest, and all of this, a lot of this other stuff, you know, goes, at least for me, went by the board. Uh-huh. But when you get up into staff positions where you have to be cognizant of all of the influences that are operating, and you have to write staff papers, or you have to make presentations, or you have to push for or against certain positions, rules, regulations, then you become across some of that. Uh-huh. But I don't think I'm being foolish when I say this, it never really bothered me personally. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it had to do with me as a person, and the fact, which may sound silly, but the fact that I'm so tall. And I don't think I was ever treated as a cuddly young little thing, mm-hmm. which some men tend to treat some women, regardless of position, mm-hmm. because of physical mm-hmm. stature. Mm-hmm. And that had never happened to me, so that was not in my way of operating or reacting to things. Mm-hmm. So the business of women in the military, I was aware of it, but not on a personal level. It had to do with the fact that I had to examine, encourage, or discourage policies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what bothered me the most.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe once or two times, I have to stretch to say that I was personally involved, but a couple of times, I think it was more personal than man and woman kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you just react as you react as a person, or as a professional,
mm-hmm.
and deal with whatever the consequences are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've read, you know, like in World War II, they would take these nurses and send them the basic training, and you're taught nursing and the army life, but then you're also taught what color lipstick you can wear and how to fix your hair, and they're not doing that anymore.
Well,
so I'm just wondering if
I never heard of that in the army.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some other people have related that
earlier
to you.
Earlier times, and I'm just wondering if
never heard of it.
In the 60s, if they wanted you to be pretty or feminine or any of that.
Well, I must as a prejudice, you know, I'm an army nurse. You must understand, and I am prejudiced about the other nurse services, and I think very much. And I used to laugh because the Air Force always seemed to have the most beautiful women in the nurse corps. And I used to swear they must have their photographs up front and they must require that they meet a certain standard of beauty. But other than that, apart from the fact that you should be well-groomed, and if you are in uniform, there are certain uniform requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, not looking like it. But I never saw anything about lipstick. We might have had something about nail polish. And I don't know if that had to do with uniform or, as a professional nurse, you would never wear colored nail polish. At least I would never wear colored nail polish in clinical care.
Mm-hmm.
It was just inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing for appearing in uniform. I never thought it was particularly appropriate to have these long, well, I never had long nails to begin with, but to have long colored fingernails in uniform is just not appropriate, because if you're in uniform, for the most part, you're in a working
mm-hmm.
uniform.
Mm-hmm.
So. But no, I never heard any rules like that.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't think that they were still around in Vietnam, but I wondered if there were any kind of leftover things that were just happening,
no.
But not policy, you know.
No, and you might, there's a couple of women here from World War II, you might try to locate them and see if that was part of their orientation.
Mm-hmm.
Just,
mm-hmm.
there's one gal who, I think she's using a walker. You might see her at the luncheon today, or you might ask someone, one of the officers of the organization will probably be able to point her out to you. She's very attractive, and she's a wonderful lady to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just ask her that one specific question about World War II.
Uh-huh.
When she came in basic, how much attention did they pay to wearing lipstick and
mm-hmm.
Nail polish and that kind
uh-huh.
of thing?
Yeah.
And that might give you a particular timeline
yeah.
on when it stopped, because I never heard of it
uh-huh.
as a requirement, no.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you thought more about women in the military when you were in, you know, higher positions.
Mm-hmm.
Did the women's movements kind of change the military's policies, or did the military have to react to, you know, more equal rights and women's liberation and that sort of thing that was starting to
happen? I think it was part of a whole cultural thing, and I think it came out of President Johnson's civil rights activities and then
mm-hmm.
the equal opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much of the military was reacting to civilian or was reacting to law.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure some of them had their definite feelings about it.
Mm-hmm.
But one interesting place to go, while I was in Washington, they dedicated one corridor in the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And since you're doing something on the military, you really need to get to the Pentagon. I don't know what the situation now is with the security requirements because of the war and the terrorist goings on. But the Pentagon has a wonderful collection, or had a wonderful collection, of displays. A lot of picture art, paintings, pictures, photographs, and also some sculpture work, different memorials to different people, different elements in the military, and they dedicated, while I was up there, a women's military corridor, a military women's corridor, rather. And it is wonderful, and in there you will get a good history, I think, because they have these different things dated, the events that they're portraying.
Mm-hmm.
And you might get a better sense than I can give you about how or why or when the military
uh-huh.
Responded.
Uh-huh.
But I think in terms of women,
even though nothing's perfect in this world, I think maybe they are in the same stance of giving opportunities to women as they are in terms of equal opportunity based on race, which they're probably far ahead of a lot of other places in this world.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they have to deal with what the general population accepts in terms of women and the combat placement policy for women, I'm sure probably has another title now. Oh, they did a very extensive and detailed study of why and where women could be assigned in different kinds of units,
mm-hmm.
and why they should or should not be excluded from different, well, they called them MOSs, but now they're areas of concentration, AOCs, specialties like pilots,
mm-hmm.
or like tank drivers and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you assigned a code to each position, and based on what the code was, which was developed because of all of these factors that you had to consider, based on what the code was, that determined whether or not a female could be assigned in that position.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't just say, well, women can't be in this position. They really, you know, all of these factors,
mm-hmm.
and then came up with this code and then determined it. And I'm sure that, you know, that has been changed and massaged over the years based on different things that have come about.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a large part of the coming about has been due to the performance of women,
mm-hmm.
in unexpected ways in
mm-hmm.
different positions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And were there specific problems that you had to deal with as a head nurse on your ward in Vietnam?
What kind of problems?
Maybe, did you have any kind of discipline problems or morale problems? Would you have to settle any, you know, problems among the nurses? Or any just regular issues that came up?
No, everybody worked 12-hour shifts, including me.
Mm-hmm.
I rotated shifts with my nurses as well. I didn't just stay on the day shift, you know, Saturday and Sunday off. I rotated shifts. I think the only morale problem we had at the one time with enlisted personnel, there was kind of a, it was an organizational thing, really. And it had to do with enlisted grade. And some of the men who had been in the military a long time had gone through training and were licensed practical nurses, and their grade was specialist 6. And their insignia of grade had a curved surface to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the men who had not been through that training, had not become licensed practical nurses, their grade was maybe E5 or E6, and they were called hard stripes because they were that sharp, you know,
mm-hmm.
triangulated look.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there was a little bit of, not friction, I don't want to use that word, but you knew that there was a little bit of turmoil
mm-hmm.
between the enlisted who were the hard stripers and the soft stripers, depending
mm-hmm.
upon the grade, if it was an equivalent grade.
Okay.
That was the only thing, and the men on my enlisted personnel, there was never any acting out of that. I just knew that that was something going on in the organization, but in terms of on my ward, there was never acted out. I had a ward master who had been in the Army for umpty-ump years, and he knew I was relatively new to the Army, and he was so supportive and helpful. And the only discussion we ever had that had a little bit of heat to it was he called me aside one day and he said, you know, head nurses in the Army don't do those things. And I said, oh, because I figured I was there to do nursing, so I was doing the nursing.
Uh-huh.
And he thought, his idea of the world was that head nurses should sit behind the desk.
Uh-huh.
I said, no, that's not for me. But after that, we were fine. We
uh-huh.
had a wonderful year, and he was just gave outstanding patient care, and he was good with the men. And I was fortunate because we had a couple of older enlisted personnel on the ward as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were particularly comforting to our patients because when the patients were admitted, they had to leave their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They could not have their weapons with them. And that made some of them, particularly the older enlisted personnel, very uncomfortable
mm-hmm.
not to have their weapons in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
But Mac, this gentleman, this one of the older personnel, he had been in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he would get to talking, and they appreciated the fact that he was an old soldier and that he'd take care of them. So that helped very
mm-hmm.
much. So, no, I didn't have any mm-hmm. personal problems. I had some individuals with personal problems, mm-hmm. but they didn't have to do with their relationships with other personnel or with taking care of patients on the ward.
Uh-huh. How did some of those older, the corpsmen who had been in for a while and were maybe older, and some of the nurses who were still enlisted, how did they feel about these young 22, 23-year-old second lieutenants coming in, being ranked higher than them, or having to take orders from them? Was that ever a problem?
No. It might have been in other places, but I never saw it, because it's a question of mutual respect.
Uh-huh.
If you and I was fortunate, the nurses, you and the young nurses on my ward, there was a mutual respect. Mm-hmm. You respected that person. He'd been in the military for a long time. He brought these skills.
Uh-huh.
You brought these skills. And no, I didn't see that. Now again, as I told you before, certain people, somebody who worked on my ward might come and tell you, oh, it was terrible, absolutely awful. So I'm not saying that I saw everything.
Uh-huh. But they just didn't voice it to
it
you.
It wasn't in my awareness. It never affected the work of the ward.
Mm-hmm.
No.
That's interesting. Yeah. Were there problems with alcohol or drugs or any of those problems?
I was told there were.
Uh-huh.
And I had one person who was affected by alcohol. But that was minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And drugs, I think there were drugs, mm-hmm. because every once in a while you could smell marijuana, but I don't know if that was patients' personnel or the local indigenous personnel who worked in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that those things were there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there were some personal problems, probably more with alcohol than anything else,
because
mm-hmm. I was there in Vietnam before, relatively early on,
mm-hmm.
and those really became problems later on.
Yeah.
So for me, one person that had to help deal with, again, a personal problem,
mm-hmm.
that might have, you know, flowed over onto the professional, but other than that, no. I was aware of it, but didn't see it mm-hmm. affecting things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What other kinds of things did you do as a head nurse on your ward?
Well, you took care of patients, you interacted with physicians, you tried to get the supplies that you needed. We were pretty much in that regard. You tried to make sure that your personnel were trained to deal with any new circumstances that might come up, because most of them didn't consider working on a medical ward. That's one thing I considered a major task and tried to spend a lot of time at, is trying to help them see the excitement in caring for medical patients, because most people think that the excitement is caring for people who are wounded in action,
mm-hmm.
rather than the people who have the medical diseases. And I was always very excited about medical stuff and bugs and communicable disease and that kind of stuff. That really turned me on. So I tried to help them develop that as well,
mm-hmm.
and try to develop systems that would help them do their work more easily.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fortunate. For example, we had a psychiatric technician. His specialty was psychiatric technician, but he had been through some basic nursing care courses before he went to the psych tech course. And I remember during TET, we were so busy. And I remember coming into the ward one morning, and he was working the night shift with one of the nurses. And I came on in the morning, and he said, "Guess what? I don't know what happened now." He said, "We have gotten all the patients have had their morning care already." And I thought, oh, what a gift that was. And so when you saw things like that happen, you felt, oh, somebody's gotten the word, you know, it's really exciting to do this kind of thing. So nice things happened as well as problems. So you did your patient care, you tried to educate personnel, you tried to interact with other units, you know, because sometimes we had patients with very bad veins. And when I wasn't the best getter into a vein of, you know, I wasn't the best putter in of IVs ever developed in the world. And so I'd go up to the anesthesia department and get one of them to come down and put the needles, because a nurse anesthetist can get into anybody's vein. And or you went up to the PAD section, the admissions and discharges sections, to settle certain problems of when patients were coming and which patients were going. One problem we did have, but this was more with the admissions and other sections of the hospital, when patients were discharged, most of them from my ward were going back to their units, and it just really bothered me terribly to have them have to put back on dirty fatigues. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that was all that was available. So I made a big stink about that, that really we need to do something and get their fatigues laundered. I mean, that may sound, you know, picayune, but in some, he's come in, he's gotten some rest, he's gotten his hydration, he's okay, he's ready to go back to duty. And it's bad enough that he has to go back to duty, but to go back to duty in worn, dirty fatigue, so I thought at least I can do that for them. That was, what other problem? Oh, one time, I forget what was going on. Were we surrounded or we, the road was blocked, something, we weren't getting supplies anyway. Weren't getting food supplies. And the mess hall, and we had to serve our patients for breakfast one morning. We had nothing to laugh at, I'm sure. We had to serve them bologna sandwiches or something, because we weren't able to get the other stuff. And that was probably, that lasted for 2 or 3 days. But then things opened up and we got supplies again. So, and again, maybe it's because the human mind, at least my mind, I tend to forget the bad and retain the good with something that has a little bit of humor to it.
Do you think on your ward you were able to become more attached to patients than on some other wards where they?
No, because our patients probably stayed less time.
Okay.
It's very iffy. Mm-hmm. Some of the surgical patients, they were sent out quickly. As soon as they were stabilized, they were moved out quickly. But some of the surgical patients just were so terribly, desperately ill that they kept them for long, long periods. And they became very attached to them. Mm-hmm. On my ward, it was kind of medium. You became attached to them.
Uh-huh.
We had some Vietnamese patients who stayed for a long time. We had some infants that they brought in. You became very attached to them. We had one little one. I still have some of the pictures with him at home. And we had to do a trach on him, tracheotomy. So he was with us for quite a while till he could be rehabilitated. You became attached to them, whether they stayed short periods or not. I remember at Christmas time, we had one side of the ward was practically all men from the 4th Division, and the other side was all from the Wounded First Airborne. It was interesting. But anyway, because there was always a little bit of rivalry, you know, between the different units, so that was interesting. But the Red Cross brought us decorations to decorate the wards, and I remember going. We had decorated. We had a little tree. My folks and their friends and my friends back home had sent me stuff, stockings, and we put stockings on the beds and we stuffed the stockings, and we put up the tree and we hung garlands around the ward.